This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here for this interview episode with David Canfield.
Hi, Katie.
David, it's the thick of Emmy season, and we've been talking to TV people for so long, so it's a real pleasure to get to talk about a movie and get to talk about Dale Dickey, who inevitably has been in something that somebody loves and seems to be getting a real showcase in the movie you're talking about today.
Yes. A leading role for an actor who most know from second long parts in a lot of TV shows and movies, sometimes minutes or minutes long. But yeah, it's a beautiful movie, a love song that premiered at Sundance. She is the lead along with Wes Studi. It's a middle-aged romance. It's got some shades of Nomadland. She plays a widow who really finds a new sense of meaning over the course of the movie. But it's got beautiful shots of the American West. They shot it near Telluride. And Dale Dickey is pretty extraordinary in it, I would say.
When I think of her, I think of her being intimidating, usually. I think a lot of that comes from Winter's Bone, which is one of the first things I remember seeing her in. But also Palm Springs, which she's really funny in.
Oh, yeah.
But it sounds like this is a real new shade of what she can do.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely talked a lot about the intimidating nature of her. Most of her past roles, she said that people will run away from her on the street sometimes. I mean, I remember one of my first, like, moments of awareness of her was when she crushed the man in Breaking Bad with an ATM machine. It's a kind of iconic visual for, a second-long performance for Dale Dickey. But yeah, this is a completely different key for her, and she was very aware of that. We also did talk about Winter's Bone a lot because she won the Independent Spirit Award for that. It was a real break for her in her career.
I mean, she is terrifying in Winter's Bone. Like,
yes.
I don't know if people, if you remember that movie at all, I think you remember her.
Yes, there's a bashing scene that is quite vivid. But yeah, she's proven she doesn't just play terrifying characters with this movie, safe
yeah.
to say.
Yeah, and she's also in A League of Their Own, which I'm hoping you talk about as well. I've seen a little bit of that, and it's she's an authority figure, but maybe not as scary, and it's a really charming performance in that, too.
We absolutely did, and it is nice that this year she's in pretty much every episode of League of Their Own, and she is the lead of this movie, and that is by far the most exposure she's ever experienced as an actor, despite being in this business for many decades, and it is something she's getting used to. It was definitely one of the more off-the-cuff interviews I've done for this podcast. I say it in the best way, and just a really delightful human who is, I think, learning to appreciate a moment that took a long time to come.
And I think what we learn over and over is it seems like every year there's someone who has a similar thing. They've been working for decades, and all of a sudden they have one thing that really makes them pop. So, we know her and we know to look forward to her, but it seems like her big breakthrough moment really could be now or anytime soon.
Yes. Let's hope that this is the first of many lead roles for Dale Dickey.
Yes. So let's hear your conversation with Dale Dickey.
Dale Dickey, you're here to talk about A Love Song, which gives you a well-deserved and perhaps rare leading role. you're nodding.
Thank you for saying well-deserved, but yes, rare is true.
What is the feeling being the face of a film, especially one that was so well-received out of Sundance and continues to find a lot of love?
It's a really new thing for me, a little overwhelming. It's lovely to have this opportunity. Max really, you know, he wrote a middle-aged love story. And the fact that Wes Studi and I are both sort of highly weathered, scarred faces. We were the perfect people for these two outdoors roamers. And I hit the lotto. I lucked out. A wonderful script and an incredibly gifted director.
Yeah, it's beautifully made. For me, you're an actor who makes an impression in every project, no matter the size of the part, which at times can be quite small. And I saw that this film's director, Max Walker-Silverman, who you mentioned, wrote you a letter, right, asking you to play the lead and describing what your work has meant to him. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, there's just nothing more heartfelt. To get a letter from a young filmmaker, and I watched his two short films before this, and I knew he had a real gift. And just his script alone was so poetic and simple and beautiful. The letter was enough to just say, I'll do it. I don't even need to read the script. It was so flattering. But I lucked out. I mean, who'd have thunk? Who'd have thunk?
As someone who's been in this business as a working actor for a long time, I'm curious just like what it meant to have the letter, to see maybe the kind of impact you can have on a filmmaker and that your work has resonated in that way. Yeah, what did that feel like?
It really is it's a beautiful, heartfelt gift that I take to heart. If someone takes the time to write you a letter saying how much they admire your work and why you're so perfect for this script, it's... You know, I've worked with more and more young filmmakers, and I told my agents over the years, you know, if I'm not missing a big money job, because I have to take money jobs, you know, when they come around. But young filmmakers have reached out, and student films, and I'm like, if I have the time, I want to do it. I like working with young filmmakers. So, you know, it makes me feel a little old. It's like I've been around a while, but it's nice that I've made some kind of impression on you know, these are our filmmakers of tomorrow, and we need new writers and new voices. So, yeah, it warms me heart. It makes me feel really good to be wanted, and then to have somebody put this faith in me that I could carry the film. I was terribly insecure about it and very nervous if I could handle it, and I wanted the challenge. You know, when you're scared of something, you got to do it. But Max was so wonderful and a terrific crew.
Yeah. So how did you find that experience of carrying a movie with Wes and finding the rhythms of the story and the tone with Max and Wes? What was the experience of making the movie like for you?
It was really glorious. It was hot. We were outdoors the whole time.
It looks hot.
Yeah, it was very hot. We filmed on Miramonte Reservoir, which is like an hour southwest of Telluride. It's a place where Max grew up. And we all had to quarantine in Telluride. Oh, it was so hard. it's a beautiful place if you're going to quarantine.
It's a beautiful
and then,
place.
Then we moved to this little tiny town of Norwood where the crew was in two different ranch houses. We were in big bubbles. And then when Wes joined us a week later, Wes and I shared a ranch house. But they brought everything to us. We did not go out. You know, we each had individual cars to drive the half hour to set. And we were masked entirely the whole time. And particularly difficult for the crew in the heat. But, you know, Max came out of NYU Film School, and he brought a lot of those kids with him, a cinematographer, and some that were in different disciplines or came after him. But all those kids had worked together, so it's a really well-oiled machine, and I just knew we could trust everybody. And everybody, yeah, you're so passionate, you know. They're not jaded yet. There's a passion. A beautifulness about young people making art. And so it's good for me to be around. And work on my craft and learn new things. But Wes and I got along just brilliantly right away. We both have same politics. We watch Jeopardy and, you know, we just hung out. And it was, you know, I don't want to ruin the movie, but there is one scene of hiking the mountain, which was our rap night. It was the most glorious rap night of my life.
Yeah, it's a beautiful scene. Yeah. We won't ruin it.
It was difficult. I was like, it's 12,000 feet. You might want to take a can of oxygen for the old lady. I didn't need it. They took good care of me. And up on that mountain, we could finally relax. It was our last night. We all tore off our masks and lay down and looked at the beautiful stars and embraced this wonderful family that we had, this journey we'd taken together. So I'm so happy the film was well received. I was really nervous about the review. I mean, not nervous. I like to know are the reviews good, hopefully favorable, but I don't like to read them solidly because you pay too much attention. But I was most relieved that I didn't mess his movie up.
The run through of Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you found the exposure to that point new at all, or perhaps intimidating?
A little bit.
A little bit?
You know, I think the only other time I went through this kind of media or large-scale film that has gotten this kind of press was when I did Winter's Bone.
Yes.
And I had that wonderful supporting role as Mirab. And, you know, in the beginning, Jennifer Lawrence and John Hawkes and I would go and do Q&As for the film to try to get the word out. And we knew it was embraced at Sundance. But so I had a little bit of a taste of this, going to some of the awards things. They would always try to include me, which was lovely. Mm. And, you know, watching Jennifer spiral away. Bye-bye. Well-deserved. What a wonderful actress and woman. I tend to be a little shy. It doesn't seem that way. I'm very gregarious. I love people. But in terms of intimacy and talking about me, I've always, it's difficult. But, you know, I'm not talking about me. We're talking about the film, right? I mean, talk about me a little bit. But the more I do interviews, the easier it is. And I'm so happy this film is going to be seen, whether they like me or not. I think it's a beautiful film. So that's where I'm staying right now, staying in the present, and whatever comes my way with, you know, more screenings and stuff, I'm there to promote it.
You mentioned learning new things and making a movie like this. I was struck by how gentle the role was and how gentle the story was in comparison, perhaps, to some of your, let's say, harsher roles and work.
Let me count the number of harsh roles. Most people that see me on the street, they run from me. They think I have an ATM machine or a chainsaw or something. I'm going to kill them. Don't let them near your children. So, yeah, this was a real gift to play someone so vulnerable and so quiet and so gentle. The same with Wes as well. Max was talking about that. The two of us are very weathered and always have played sort of violent, tough people, and to show us in a gentler light was really kind of lovely to play. I haven't gotten to do that much, and so it was new and it felt different, but Max was so good about I think he had studied acting years ago before he went to film school, studied theater and history, and so he knows how to talk to actors quietly and gently and keep you centered, keep me centered, so that I don't fall into Dale's. See, I'm very animated, as you can tell, and Faye is very concise and very routine is very important. So I wanted to really, I wanted to make sure I could find that stillness and that quiet. It's not hard in that environment. You know, that's the star of the film, is this is the beautiful place we shot in.
Yeah, it really just, you're a part of the landscape in a really beautiful way.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
I'm curious, you've done many independent films. Being top of the call sheet for this one, had you, over your career, witnessed how actors have handled being in that spot and how to sort of be the focal point of the cast and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I've worked, I've been so grateful and lucky to work as much as I have on a lot of different sets with a lot of different people. And I'm not sure I'd been number one before, maybe on a couple of student films, but it still, the number thing never really meant much to me. It just meant that you had so supposedly a lot of lines to say, but in this, it's just more quiet. But yeah, it was important to me. It's important to me on a set to, you know, we all have our moments, and I was struggling to quit smoking, and so, you know, my head can turn quickly, but I try to always work well with others and respect, you know, coming from theater, you respect all the other disciplines, and I'm only as good as the people I'm working with, and they're the ones making me look good, and I trusted our crew, and, you know, it was mostly with my big old face on screen the whole time gonna work.
I did want to go back to Winter's Bone for one moment. We are an awards podcast, and I do remember the moment you won the Indie Spirit Award, which felt like a very deserved honor. What do you remember about that? Really, that whole flurry and yeah, that being the culmination, perhaps, for you on that tour.
That was nerve-wracking for me, and I remember very little about that entire evening, and I wasn't drinking, so, you know, I was in good shape. I was so excited just to be there, and I knew the film had been embraced by Film Independent, and I knew that they liked Winner's Bone. I never expected to win. I was really thrilled and honored to be nominated, but I did know that that award was coming first, and that made me terribly nervous. Plus, you know, it's like, keep it to 30 seconds. And then all the producers are saying, don't thank us. You don't need to thank us. We know you're thankful. And so I get up there and I completely forget to thank Jennifer Lawrence, number one. Excuse me, but that's the reason I was there. And I tell you what, I learned a lot from that young lady. She's raw talent at its best and a good human being. But yeah, I was so nervous. I don't really remember what happened. I remember getting up on stage and looking out into the audience and seeing so many big stars. And I landed on Jesse Eisenberg, sweet little Jesse with his curly hair. And he was just sitting like right in the center, just smiling at me. So I thought, Dale, just keep looking at Jesse. You don't know him, he doesn't know you, but he's giving you good energy and you're nervous. Maybe he's supporting you. But I know whenever I finished, I turned to exit the stage, and I'm pretty sure it was Mark Ruffalo that he'd been there to give the award. I kind of collapsed into Mark's arms, crying and laughing and in shock. And I know he was like, what the hell? Get her off of me and get her into the press. And then I'd never done that whirlwind thing. I thought I just got to go back out and sit at the table. I wanted to see John and Jennifer get their awards. And then they take you through all the stuff. And I kept going, can I stop and watch TV? I want to see my friends. So it was overwhelming and exciting. And it was just such a new thing for me. It was like being the belle of the ball. And I'd never experienced that before. You just got to take a deep breath and relax and enjoy being there and why you're there and celebrating everyone's work. It's really what it's about. Mm.
Did it change the direction of your career at all? I know that you'd before Winter's Bone, particularly, you'd done a lot of bit parts, particularly in television shows.
Of course, it did. I think, you know, everybody always talks about a big break. I'm like, little breaks over the years, you know, starting in theater in New York. And then with Winter's Bone, I knew when I got that audition, I knew this was a casting director I'd never met before. And I knew they did really good films. I knew I fit into that world. I had no idea Deborah would cast me as Mirab, but we had a great audition. But certainly the exposure of that film, the fact that it did so well, and I think it's such a wonderful film, very proud to have been a part of it, that certainly put me at a different level in terms of my agents being able to get me into the room to meet new casting directors. So, it was a turning point. You know, one thing just leads to the other. And I mean, Breaking Bad came out. That's when people, I don't know what it is. I spent 3 hours in the makeup chair getting lesions put on my face. But if you recognize me, that's fine. It's the chin and the hair, you know.
It's unforgettable. I have to say that is probably, it had to have been 2009, right? Around then.
It was. I think I filmed it 2008, 2009. It was right. You know what? I had just finished filming Breaking Bad, and my agents called and said, you have a meeting with Deborah Granik as soon as you get off the plane. That was that day. I had come back from Breaking Bad, and my husband picked me up at the airport and took me, and I went straight in. So maybe I was just on a high, and that helped me.
Oh, wow.
A skank high.
The skank high. The sound of the crashing ATM machine echoing.
Right. You're the skank. You're the hooker. And I'm like, could you please clarify it was on My Name is Earl or Breaking Bad?
Yes, that does say a lot. We need to get specifics beyond that. You did mention people running from you in terror, which I do think is a testament to, first of all, you watch a movie like A Love Song and there is such vulnerability to your work. And it's really affecting and sweet. And there is also a real ability on your part to play very intense, harsh characters. And that did seem like, especially in the smaller parts that you took on earlier in your career, I don't necessarily want to call it typecasting, but I'm curious how it felt for you and how you came to start playing a lot of those kinds of parts.
I've told this story before, but years ago when I started off in New York, because I came from theater and I just wasn't auditioning well, and I took a casting director workshop, and I was like, I want to do my Ophelia. It was classically trained and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, no, you don't get it. You need to do your Southern. You need to do Beth Henley monologues. I was like, no, I don't want to be typecast as Southern. But he was basically saying, that is what you want. That's what you do better than anyone else. That's what is in your soul and your heart. You may not have a thick Southern accent, but you grew up there, your rhythm. So I started embracing some of the Southern roles that I'd been shying away from, because I did need to be typecast. Hollywood, particularly when I moved to LA, it's like they have a very specific look that they want. And I knew I was not the normal kind of look, the beautiful leading girl. In one of my first auditions when I was in LA was for the police shows, would have been like in 96. And I walked in to read for the next door neighbor that baked pies. And I literally walked in the room and the director looked at me and he went, can you come back tomorrow and read for the heroin addict? Because this face, I learned early on, it's a strong face. It reads hard. It reads Appalachian. I can have a little mean mouth. There's just something that reads rural and tough. And I accepted that, you know. I grew more and more comfortable with my face as I went along. And I don't know what it is about those tough, gritty roles, but I sure do love playing them. It might be that I have trouble with anger in real life, and perhaps that's why I'm drawn to those roles.
It's a great outlet.
But I can't use it for that. But I love trying to find the humanity in anyone who's on the margin or down and out. There's always some sort of hope and heart in there somewhere, and to try to bring that to every role I play. But Love Song, you know, I don't think Faye has too many skeletons in her closet, so.
Yeah. Does it almost change the way perhaps you see yourself as an actor? You've mentioned your face a few times now, and I think the movie really has this, it's beautifully shot, but it does really embrace your face and Wes's face in all of it, right? And it does take on a different connotation to say its place in an episode of Breaking Bad, as you were saying.
Right. And, well, one of the things I can't remember, but what I really loved about some of the reviews from Sundance were that they embraced the fact that Wes and I are older character actors, and like unapologetic close-ups of my face. And I got tickled because I think they were all trying to find a nice way to say she's wrinkled as shit. And instead, like someone said, gloriously grooved or wondrously weathered. And so that's my new t-shirt. You know, it's Botox is not for me. And I love it that I can use my weathered face and still feel beautiful. It's hard to, but being in the outdoors, I feel beautiful no matter. You know, years ago, I starting out, like even in college, I always played everyone under 12 or over 50. And my professors in school were like, you're going to fall between the cracks. And then sure enough, when I started in the business, it was like they want you to fit a certain mold. And it's you're not pretty enough this way, and you're not quirky enough this way. So you sort of keep falling between the cracks. And then, you know, I came into my own the older I got. And I tell young students when I talk to them, it's like, doesn't happen overnight. I didn't expect it to. I just was going to keep going. But I was 45 when I finally could quit my day job and started working. So, you know, Time Daily told me years ago, embrace your face because you're going to work more and more as you get older. And so thank you, Time. I hope this is not the end of it now.
Well,
I don't mind doing supporting roles. Look, baby, I just love to work.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
You've got a love song, and you also are in the A League of Their Own reboot coming up. And you're a regular in that, correct?
Well, kind of, sort of, not. When we did the pilot, I was recurring. I play the girl's chaperone. The chaperone's pretty much always there, and unless they're sneaking out at night or the privacy of their rooms. They were their everything, and I love playing that role. The girls were terrific, but when they went into series, it's like because the chaperone is there, so I'm in the background every time we're on the field, you know.
Right.
I have to be there. So I'm written into every episode, but I'm not considered a regular. I was a recurring, but it was a wonderful job, and I learned a lot. I love doing period pieces, and the girls were terrific. We had a great time, and I think it's going to be a really good series. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing how people react to this new, more expanded version, because it covers a lot of different things.
Yeah. So between that and A Love Song, it's two pretty substantial projects for you coming out in the same year.
They were actually originally going to be released on the same day, on July 29th. Then, this was weird, I go to Tribeca for A Love Song. Our big screening was on like Monday night, the 15th, 16th of something of June. It was the same night they premiered League of Their Own at Tribeca, except it was 2 hours earlier. So I was like, well, this is fun. I'm completely playing, you know, opposite characters. And wow, this won't ever happen again. So, it's exciting. And I've been so lucky. I've been so lucky to work as much as I have, but particularly during COVID, I've been shocked. Yeah. I mean, it's hard. You got to follow all the rules. You know, we want to keep it going. We got to keep it going.
Yeah. Well, maybe it will happen again.
Never know.
Never know. Certainly, I would call it overdue, and it's wonderful to see.
Thank you. That's really, really, really lovely. It's very kind. I mean, I love what I do. I've been in this business a really long time, and I, you know, if I didn't still love it, I wouldn't do it. So of course, it's nice to get recognition for something, particularly something I was so scared about doing lead role. Yeah.
Well, here's to hoping more new challenges and opportunities are on the way. Dale Dickey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. And here's to hoping I have interviewers as nice as you.
I'll take that.
That does it for today's interview episode. We'll be back on Thursday with our regular roundtable conversation. In the meantime, find us at vanityfair.com. Find us on Twitter at littlegoldmen. And on our own, I'm at Katie Rich. And David?
David Canfield, 97.
And you can sign up to text with us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 213-513-4203. And a reminder that our book club series is kicking off in August. The first title up will be Women Talking by Miriam Toews. So read along and join us. Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.